Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So, what we'll do is we'll read the verses and the purports, most of which are very short, and say a few things about the main points. So, does anybody want to start reading 27?
The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "Know from me that this is the act of the son of Drona. He has thrown the hymns of nuclear energy, Brahmastra, and he does not know how to retract the glare. He has helplessly done this, being afraid of imminent death."
So just to bring us up to date, basically what happened was Ashwatthama killed the sleeping sons of Draupadi, and Arjuna was determined to chastise him and began chasing after him, and then out of fear, Ashwatthama, who is referred to as the son of Drona, was running, and he realized that he was in deep trouble, basically, and the only thing he could do is for this ultimate weapon, which is what he's done. So that's where we are now. Want to read the purport?
The Brahmastra is similar to the modern nuclear weapon manipulated by atomic energy. The atomic energy works wholly on total combustibility, and so the Brahmastra also acts. It creates an intolerable heat similar to atomic radiation, but the difference is that the atomic bomb is a gross type of nuclear weapon, whereas the Brahmastra is a subtle type of weapon produced by chanting hymns. It is a different science, and in the days gone by, such science was cultivated in the land of Bharatvarsha. The subtle science of chanting hymns is also material, but it has yet to be known by the modern material scientists. Subtle material science is not spiritual, but it has a direct relationship with the spiritual method, which is still subtler. A chanter of hymns knew how to apply the weapon as well as how to retract it. That was perfect knowledge, but the son of Dronacharya, who made use of this subtle science, did not know how to retract. He applied it, being afraid of his imminent death, and thus the practice was not only improper, but also irreligious. As a son of a Brahmin, he should not have made so many mistakes, and for such gross negligence of duty, he was to be punished by the Lord himself.
So there's a couple points here. One is just the discussion of the Brahmastra and what it is, and then the other is how foolish Ashwatthama was to have actually used it in his ignorance. So this Brahmastra, it differs from the atomic weapons that we have now, because it could be directed very precisely. There was that later on we'll see how Ashwatthama, I believe it was, uses another Brahmastra to try to kill Parikshit in the womb. So you couldn't direct an atomic weapon to abort an embryo. That's basically, it blows up a large section of a city, you know. So these weapons were a lot more user friendly and more precise and more directable than the nuclear weapons. And there's also a way to retract them. Now, once you drop an atom bomb, there isn't anything you can do. It's going to blow up. You can't like say, "Oh, let me retract it." there's no. So this is a very sophisticated, subtle science, which is unknown. And there are many such sciences in the Vedas that are unknown to modern science. And many of the and actually in the one of the difficulties with the because there's so many supernatural things in the Vedic literature, basically the academic community doesn't take it as historically accurate. You know, like the Mahabharata, there's so many like things that they think are impossible. Therefore, they don't accept it as a real history. And then they try to create a history of India based on their archaeology. So it's something that we have to know about, and you know that's what's going on. Basically, they don't accept literally 5,000 years ago Krishna came. Although there is actually some there is some astronomical evidence, because in the Mahabharata certain positions of stars at certain key times are described, and if you actually work out the astronomy, you can show that actually it was 5,000 years ago. But because they don't accept any of the literalness of it, they have to like invent some kind of history of India, and which is of course erroneous. So but one could actually investigate these sciences. Actually, there's Sadhapuda has this book called Alien Identities, which talks about relationships between UFOs and the Vimanas, which are the Vedic flying machines, and the extraterrestrials, and the these different. We hear there's 400,000 human-like species, all kinds of different things. And so there's relationships between these UFO entities and some of the entities in the Vedic literature. So, at any rate, there's also elaborate shastra that talks about building of Vimanas, or Vedic flying machines, and that there's certain alloys that have amazing properties for being super strong and super light, and that some scientists had actually like tried to build some create some of the materials that these flying machines were made of following the directions, and was able to create some of these amazing alloys with incredible properties. So one could actually, if one had faith that these things actually, these sciences were true, one could actually perform scientific experiments and show that there was advanced knowledge in ancient times. It also turns out that there's an astronomical measurement that we come up in the Yojana, and it turns out there's evidence that that's actually corresponds to a degree of latitude. So for it to correspond to a degree of latitude, first you have to know that the Earth is round, and then you have to know how big it is, and then you can figure out what size a degree of latitude is. So it's very amazing that there's a correspondence between the Yojana and a degree of latitude, because the scientists don't think that there was as advanced knowledge in India hundreds and thousands of years ago. Does anybody have any questions on that, the Brahmastra? I don't know much about it. Then the other point made was that Drona, he knew that he couldn't retract it, but because he was so scared of his life, he released this weapon anyway. So it's described in the Bhagavad Gita. There's the qualities of the different modes are described, one in goodness, one in passion, one in ignorance. And when one performs an activity without considering the future consequences of that activity, or how much harm it will cause to other people, when that isn't part of the calculation, he does something and he doesn't consider at all how much it'll harm people, that's in the mode of ignorance. And that is how this unqualified son of a brahmana was acting out of fear of his life. So we can continue. 28.
O Arjuna, only another brahmastra can counteract this weapon. Since you're expert in military science, subdue this weapon's glare with the power of your weapon.
Report.
For the atomic bombs, there's no counter weapon to neutralize the effects. But by subtle science, the action of a Brahmastra can be counteracted. And those who are expert in the military science in those days could counteract the Brahmastra. The son of Dronacharya did not know the act of counteracting the weapon, and therefore Arjuna was asked to counteract it by the power of his own weapon.
So, let's see, is there anything in addition we could say about this? So I guess we can continue. Read
29. Sri Sita Goswami said, hearing this from the personality of Godhead, Arjuna touched water for purification, and after circumambulating Lord Sri Krishna, he cast his Brahmastra weapon to counteract the other one.
The rays of the two Brahmastras combined, a great circle of fire like the disk of the sun covered all outer space and the whole firmament of planets.
Yeah, sure.
Purport. The heat created by the flash of a Brahmastra resembles the fire exhibited in the sun globe at the time of cosmic annihilation. The radiation of atomic energy is very insignificant in comparison to the heat produced by a Brahmastra. The atomic bomb explosion can at utmost blow up one globe, but the heat produced by the Brahmastra can destroy the whole cosmic situation. The comparison is therefore made to the heat at the time of annihilation.
So this is a very amazing weapon that it can be directed like we'll see is... When he attacks Mars Pariksit in the womb, it can be directed in a very precise way, but at the same time, it has the potential power to destroy much more than an atomic weapon, destroy the more than a planet, which is pretty amazing. Yes. Well, let's see. Well, it says I think because it happened in outer space, I would say that it didn't happen like right next to the right in the vicinity of where things were. It says that they felt the heat of it, but it wasn't. We haven't read that one yet. Why don't we read the next one? Describes a little bit more. Let's read the next one.
All the population of the three worlds was scorched by the combined heat of the weapons. Everyone was reminded of the Sambartika fire, which takes place at the time of the annihilation. The three worlds are the upper, lower, and intermediate planets of the universe. Although the Brahmastra was released on this earth, the heat produced by the combination of both weapons covered all the universe, and all the populations and all the different planets began to feel the heat excessively and compared it to that of the Sambartika fire. No planet, therefore, is without living beings, as less intelligent materialistic men think.
I think also another feature of it was that the duration which this heat lasted for wasn't very long, because we can tolerate heat for a short time, like even a very hot temperature, but for a length of time there's no way we could tolerate it. So it couldn't have been hot enough that it like burned you, like, you know, just touching a flame or something like that. But it was just it was hot briefly like that, hot enough so you felt it, but not hot enough so it caught your body on fire like that. I mean, it couldn't have been that hot, because like, if something's really hot, like, you know, like fire, like a piece of paper will like burst into flames or something. But so it must have been further enough away from the planets that it didn't, and also brief enough that it didn't, I would say. Continue, next one.
Thus, seeing the disturbance of the general populace and the imminent destruction of the planet, Arjuna at once retracted both Brahmastra weapons as Lord Sri Krishna desired. The theory that the modern atomic bomb explosions can annihilate the world is childish imagination. First of all, the atomic energy is not powerful enough to destroy the world. And secondly, ultimately, it all rests in the supreme will of Supreme Lord, because without his will or sanction, nothing can be built or destroyed. It is foolish also to think that the natural laws are ultimately powerful. Material nature's law works under the direction of the Lord. As confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita, the Lord says there that natural laws work under his supervision. The world can be destroyed only by the will of the Lord and not by the whims of tiny politicians. Lord Sri Krishna desired that the weapons released by both Durrani and Arjuna be withdrawn, and it was carried out by Arjuna at once. Similarly, there are many agents of the all-powerful Lord, and by his will only can one execute what he desires.
So that's an important point, that that calamities can only happen if Krishna allows them to happen, because ultimately he's behind everything, and if he didn't, and he didn't want things annihilated at this point, of course he could have counteracted it himself. But he is, he knew that Arjuna could counteract it, and therefore he always likes to glorify his devotee and give his devotee the opportunity to show his prowess, just as a and that was a service also, a service Arjuna could perform for Krishna. The devotee always takes pleasure in serving Krishna, so here's an opportunity. Arjuna was like the star student of Dronacharya in all kinds of military weapons. So here he could use his expertise and his Brahmastra knowledge to serve Krishna. So that, there's that aspect to it. So we don't have to worry about 2012 for one thing. So there may be some temporary economic collapse or this or that, but it's not like the world will be destroyed. Any other points about this or? Well, Well, Ashvatthama apparently still exists in the Himalayas, waiting out Kali Yuga. But and there's still yogis who have different powers like that. I mean, some of the yogic powers are more amazing, perhaps. But generally, most of this science isn't around now, and so it's not likely that there are people who are aware of it. Like most of the There's very few people who know the Vedic knowledge, and people have to have higher qualifications to do these things than the people. Now, generally, people had to perform a certain amount of tapasya to get any amazing power, and there's not so many people who are willing to perform any. You meet people in India who have different powers. That when I was in India, there was this guy who could, if you lost something, he could tell you who took it and where it was, like that. And he said he worshipped Durga for 18 years to get this power. So, I told you that story before. Basically, there was I was researching paranormal phenomena for Sataputta, and I was also on pilgrimage in Mayapur, so I decided to do both things at once. So I heard about these guys, so I decided I would test them out. I had some brahmachari take something out of my bag and put it somewhere. So then we went to see this guy who was over by the there's across the Jalangi, there's medical ISKCON medical facility, and there's a Jagannath temple, and over in that area there was this guy was living who supposedly had these powers. So I got one of the Gurukul students to be my translator, and we went over there and explained that somebody had taken something out of my bag, and I came up with 10 questions. Was the person was he from the West? Was he from India? Was he tall? Was he short? Was he thin? Was he fat? Was he wearing like traditional dress, or was he wearing Western clothes? I came up with like 10 different questions, and the guy got them all right, and I was really surprised. And then I said, what is his occupation? And he said, at your Mayapur complex, you have many, many booths where they sell books, and the person who took your thing is one of the book salesmen. And it was all true. So I was, there are still people who have special powers there. And yeah, he said that it was in the Brahmacharya Ashram, and it was under a stack of other things. And he had hidden it under a stack of other things. In the Brahmacharya. He could see it was under, it was under a stack of things. You know, vision. Yeah. And he also claimed to be able to take bones that were broken and set them so that you could walk on them in like 3 or 4 days instead of like 6 weeks like it usually is. And that is something you would be very easy to test out. You just, you know, make some agreement with some hospital in Calcutta and take the guy down there and see if you could actually pull it off. But I wasn't ambitious enough to do that. But that's for future research. Anybody wants to? So there are subtle sciences that are from the Vedic literature that people know, but and they could be investigated. Continuing 33.
Arjuna, his eyes blazing in anger, like two red balls of copper, dexterously arrested the son of Gautami and bound him with ropes like an animal. Ashwatthama's mother, Kripi, was born in the family of Gautama. The significant point is in this shloka is that Ashwatthama was caught and bound up with ropes like an animal. According to Sridhar Swami, Arjuna was obliged to catch this son of a Brahmana like an animal as a part of his duty, dharma. This suggestion by Sridhar Swami is also confirmed in the later statement of Sri Krishna. Ashwatthama was a bona fide son of Dronacharya and Kripi, but because he had degraded himself to a lower status of life, it was proper to treat him as an animal and not as a Brahmana.
So this is a... There's a tendency to take one's status to be according to their birth. But actually one's status is actually according to one's activities. this one verse by Narada, where he says that if someone born in a Shudra family has the qualifications of a Brahmana, he should actually be considered and treated as a Brahmana. Whereas if somebody born in a Brahmana family has the qualifications of a Shudra, he should be considered to be a Shudra. Because, and we know this from Bhagavad Gita, just that verse 4:13, where Krishna describes that that the varna one's in is based on guna and karma. It's not based on janma. Chaturvarnim mayashristam guna karma vibhagashana, by qualities and by work. So it was the most unrighteous thing to kill innocent people in their sleep. Actually, in the Vedic Kshatriyas, they wouldn't kill women and children at all. They'd just fight other warriors, and they would only fight other warriors, like if they were, they wouldn't, if one had weapons and the other didn't, the other one would drop his weapons and then fight them hand to hand. They wouldn't, there were certain rules, and like in that, the people had to be equally matched. It wasn't like that came up that when Jarasandha he was choosing who to fight, Arjuna, Krishna, or Bhima. He chose Bhima because he felt he was equally in the same category. So the question of killing someone who was, people who were unarmed, or women or children, it was something completely unthinkable. It was something so low class and crude that a warrior would be embarrassed to do something like that. So he wasn't qualified as a Brahmin or as a Kshatriya. He was really on the lowest level. And therefore, as Prabhupada said, that because he degraded himself to the lower status of life, it was proper to treat him as an animal and not as a brahmana. So that's a very heavy statement. But so I think we'll read the next one, 34.
After binding Ashwatthama, Arjuna wanted to take him to the military camp. The personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, looking on with his lotus eyes, spoke to angry Arjuna. Both Arjuna and Lord Sri Krishna are described here in an angry mood, but Arjuna's eyes are like balls of red copper, whereas the eyes of the Lord were like lotuses. This means that the angry mood of Arjuna and that of the Lord are not on the same level. The Lord is transcendence, and thus he is absolute in any stage. His anger is not like the anger of a conditioned living being within the modes of qualitative material nature. Because he is absolute, both his anger and pleasure are the same. His anger is not exhibited in the three modes of material nature. It is only a sign of his bent of mind towards the cause of his devotee, because that is his transcendental nature. Therefore, even if he is angry, the object of anger is blessed. He is unchanged in all circumstances.
So, there's a difference between Krishna's anger and our anger. Krishna's benevolent even when he's angry, and he's not carried away by anger. The conditioned soul can become carried away by anger and do things that are completely self-destructive to themselves and to others, but Krishna's anger is actually meant to benefit everyone, actually, the person who is angry at in a human, the whole human society. So the reason why Krishna becomes angry is because we are all children of Krishna. Every living being is a child of Krishna. So Krishna loves everyone, but when one of the children decides to cause harm to another one of his children, Krishna doesn't like it. And that you can see in your own family, if you start beating up on your sister or your brother, your parents won't like it. They'll be upset with you because of love. So the anger of Krishna is when there's unrighteous cruelty because of affection for his parts and parcels, and especially for his devotee. He has love for everyone, but he has extra love for his devotee because he's reciprocating the devotee's love for him. The regular anger of the conditioned soul is described in Bhagavad Gita. There's this verse that goes, Jayata Vishaya Pumsam, while contemplating the objects of the senses, Sangat Teshu Pajayate, one acquires attachment for them. Sangat Sanjayate Kama, whom attachment lust arises, and so forth. Then from the lust, anger develops. When anger is there, one's deluded, one's memory is bewildered, one's intelligence is lost, and one falls down to the material pool. So the common man's anger is basically when his lusty desires are frustrated, he becomes angry. But that's completely different than the anger of Krishna or the anger of the pure devotee. Krishna or the pure devotee become angry when religious principles are violated, when innocent people are caused pain. So it's not based on the frustration of some material desire. It's a completely different. And in the pastimes of Srila Prabhupada, there were incidences when some devotee would do something stupid, and Prabhupada would be really angry and speak to them harshly. And after that, then he would continue a conversation with somebody else in a perfectly normal tone of voice without any indication of the anger that was previously present, just to instruct this person. He was like completely using anger as a tool to make a point to a devotee, but then in 1 second leaving it aside and going on in his normal conversational voice with another devotee about something else. Right? He showed that that his anger was just a tool for instruction, and not a reaction to some some frustration on his part. In there's one purport where Prabhupada talks about how these different bad qualities like anger can be engaged in Krishna's service, and he glorifies both Arjuna and Hanuman as who are great Vaishnavas and perfect devotees who are glorified for their action in anger. Arjuna killing all these demoniac sons of Dhritarashtra and their friends, and Hanuman burning down the city of Lanka for the protection of Mother Sita. So there are instances where anger is right, but for the ordinary person, it's just a reaction to frustration to get some desirable thing. Another instance of anger that comes up in the Shastra that's interesting is the case of the who the Kumaras, they were stopped from being allowed to go to Vaikuntha. They wanted to see the Lord. And then in anger they cursed the doorkeepers. So that was but that desire to see the Lord was a transcendental desire. It wasn't just like, you know, the ordinary desire of somebody to gratify their senses in this world. And therefore they're not condemned for that anger, because it had a devotional component to it. Does anybody have any questions or comments or realizations about anger? Yes? Yeah? Okay. Is it related to this any of the topics we've discussed today, or is it just...
Why is this pastime started, like the narration of Krishna's pastimes? I mean, why does it start here? What's the importance of this being the first story told?
Well, one thing I've heard about these sorts of things are there in the Mahabharata. These pastimes that we're hearing about now, and the when Vyasadeva wrote the Mahabharata, he wasn't really focused on making it clear to glorify Krishna exclusively or prominently in the Mahabharata. So in this first canto of the Bhagavatam, he's retelling a lot of the things that were in the Mahabharata, but he's putting Krishna in the center and Krishna's devotees in the center. He's making up for his telling of these pastimes previously without focus on Krishna. He's retelling them in the proper way, where one is focused on Krishna and his devotees and devotional service. So that's not the specific pastime. Well, this sort of leads up, and so that's one aspect to it. And another is it leads up to the narration of the Srimad Bhagavatam, because the narration of the Srimad Bhagavatam is Shukadeva Goswami speaking to Maharaj Parikshit. So why was Maharaj Parikshit king? So he was king because he was the only descendant of the Pandavas. And one of the reasons he was the only descendant is because all these other people were wiped out by Ashvatthama. And he almost was wiped out by Ashvatthama too, but he was protected by Krishna. And therefore, and that is told about in the beginning of the next chapter, I believe, how Maharaj Pariksit is protected personally by Krishna. So we're sort of like leading up to the recitation of the Bhagavatam. But those two things are there. Yeah. Yes?
If our anger is worthy, or if we should check ourselves.
Well, we have to sort of to see if there is a material desire that's being frustrated, that's the cause of it. Just like think about, you know, what why am I getting angry? Is it is it like, suppose somebody impedes our devotional service, right? That's really what happened with the Kumaras. You know, Jayan Vijayan impeded their devotional service. So that's getting angry, that your devotional service is impeded is it's not the same as just getting angry because for your sense gratification, really. Because of it, the attachment to Krishna, there's a purifying aspect to that anger, because it's out of attachment to Krishna that your service to Krishna that you get angry. But if it's just some, you know, whimsical sense gratification that has nothing to do with devotional service, and it's not some whimsical desire, and it's not fulfilled, and you get frustrated like that, then it's completely material. And then even if somebody impedes our service, then we have to understand, well, you know, it's my karma that so-and-so is impeding my service. There's like an amazing pastime where Prabhupada was like giving a lecture, you know, and somebody just stood up and just said tons of nasty things about Srila Prabhupada right in the middle of the lecture, and all the devotees are really upset. And Prabhupada said afterwards that, well, he must have been an enemy from a former life or something. Prabhupada didn't take it too seriously. He didn't get really upset and said, you know, we have to punish this guy, or we, you know, whatever. he saw it as, you know. So we have to understand whatever happens to us, it's our karma. But it's good to analyze it, because if we're getting upset because our devotional service is impeded, that's not so bad as if we're getting upset because of some whimsical desire for sense gratification not being fulfilled. Yeah. Yes? Well, we should never become so hopelessly despondent that we abandon the path of devotional service. Like some people, they become frustrated with their lack of progress, so they give up. So that's a manifestation of illusion, of course, right? Because if you give up, you'll never attain success, right? So and another aspect is that we're not in control of the result ever. We're only in control of how much we try. You know? So if we're trying to surrender to Krishna to the best of our ability, and we're not so successful, we shouldn't be upset about that, because we're trying to do the best we can, really, and the result's really up to Krishna. So we have to consider also that we've been conditioned for many, many millions of births, and we're trying to completely go in the opposite direction. You know? Right now, at this point in history, this is the Kali Yuga. So in the Kali Yuga, the mode of ignorance is prominent. Right? In the mode of ignorance, we feel spontaneously the urge to do just the opposite of that which will benefit us. If we're supposed to get up early, our natural tendency is to sleep in late. You know? If we're supposed to glorify the Vaishnavas, our natural tendency is to criticize the Vaishnavas. You know, so just the whole age that we're living in is just going the opposite direction that we're trying to go. So we shouldn't be too upset about our failures to live up to our, you know, but we should try hard and try to improve. We shouldn't think that we're doing good enough, you know, but we shouldn't be hopelessly upset about ourselves, because it's understandable, And that's how we're going to have difficulty because of our conditioning and because of the bad features of this age. But because Krishna appreciates the sentiments of service, that if we just try the best we can, he'll reciprocate with that. And so, anything else? Let's see. I guess I saw you first. Right. Right. That doesn't happen at the end of the Kali Yuga. It's that's at the time of universal annihilation, which is at the end of Brahma's life, like that. So we don't have to worry about that for a while. We don't even have to worry about the end of Kali Yuga. We have to worry about assisting Lord Chaitanya in spreading his Sankirtan movement, which is supposed to increase for the next 4,500 years and affect a large part of human society with devotional inspiration, piety, and spiritual ecstasy. So that's our role. We're very fortunate. We're appearing in a time where we can assist Lord Chaitanya in expanding the Hare Krishna movement to every town and village. So we should look for a town and village where we can represent Lord Chaitanya. And his program is described briefly, Bolo Krishna, Baja Krishna, Kora Krishna, Shikha. To chant Hare Krishna, to worship Krishna, and to study and to execute the directions, the instructions of Krishna. That's, in summary, his mission. Amrita Kaili.
If we find ourselves becoming frustrated or critical of other devotees, even if it doesn't affect our service, how should we do go about that?
Well, the say again. What did you say?
I said in a matter of time it will.
Oh yeah, right.
Let me rephrase it. It's not that our frustration will or will not affect our service. It's if the reason why we're frustrated with them doesn't have anything to do with us. We're just finding ourselves becoming like that.
Well, basically, Srila Prabhupada described our situation as practicing devotees to be like somebody who's in the shower becoming clean, and that we can't, if somebody's really in the shower and they're really scrubbing, right, it's just a matter of time before they'll be clean. So we shouldn't be preoccupied with the material tendencies of the devotees because they're rightly situated and they'll be reduced in the course of time like that. So the real problem is with people who aren't taking the devotional service seriously enough that they're going to become purified anytime soon. Then that would be more of a problem. You know? But if people really are applying themselves to the sadhana and the service, you know, both things, the chanting and the study and the rendering of service to the Vaishnavas, it's just a matter of time before they'll be purified, and then that. So it's our we have to practice the tolerance like that. And you can meditate on Srila Prabhupada, how tolerant he was, you know, washing the dishes of all the hippies and waiting in line for using that to use the bathroom, and all kinds of things that he put up with. And then if you can think of ways that the people can overcome these, that, like if they're doing things that annoy you, that you could advise them not to do it because it's in their you could present to them how it's in their self-interest to change their behavior, then you can do that, you know. Because sometimes people aren't aware that what they're doing is disturbing someone. And if they were aware, then they could change their behavior, you know. So that's also there, you know.
Between us being overly critical. I mean, we could just be being overly critical. It could be
right.
A problem in our mind. Not
right.
Maybe they have some issue, but all devotees have some issue.
Right.
So if we're being overly critical, can't that be very damaging for our spiritual
life? Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's why if you see that, well, whatever problem is, it's very soon by the devotional service is so powerful because they're engaged in devotional service. Whatever things are, difficulties that they things they do, they disturb my mind. They're insignificant. Therefore, I won't consider them. You know, you can dismiss it that way. You know, thinking, well, it's just a very small thing which will be washed away by the devotional service. Why should I let it disturb me like that? Yeah, that's the idea.